This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castillo. Thousands of migrants from violent and poverty-stricken countries that make up the Northern Triangle of Central America, that's Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, are traveling in large caravans from their homes throughout Mexico to its border with the United States. Most say they are making what is described as an exhausting and dangerous trip in hopes of being granted asylum and a better life in the United States. Upon hearing news of this mass movement of people headed for the U.S., President Trump said he would take steps that would prevent them from entering the U.S. illegally. Meanwhile, the European Union continues to face challenges brought on by its massive influx of refugees from parts of Africa and the Middle East over the past 3 years. Experts say that the EU's refugee crisis has had a profound impact on many of Europe's nations. Today, we'll talk about the challenges of mass migration. Joining me today in the VOA Broadcast Center are Hans von Spakovsky, manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and senior legal fellow with the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative-leaning think tank based here in Washington, D.C. Also with me is Luca D'Alolio, who is chief of mission for the Washington Office of the International Organization for Migration and board member of USA for IOM. The International Organization for Migration is an intergovernmental organization that provides services and advice concerning migration to governments, migrants, including internally displaced persons, and refugees. Gentlemen, thank you both
for joining us today. Thanks for having us, Rick.
Thank you for inviting me.
My first question to you, Luca, is we're talking about the caravan that is currently making their way up. As a matter of fact, it's more than one caravan. It's a number of caravans. These people are coming from the Northern Triangle of Central America. Tell us a bit about these people and why they have decided to make such a trip with so many risks and an unknown future.
The caravan, rather the caravan, since you rightly say, seems to be evolving every day with new numbers and new directions and new features. Just today I was informed that, in fact, there is a fourth caravan that is leaving El Salvador with about 1,300 members moving towards Guatemala. At the moment, there are four caravans, and the composition of these groups is still being assessed. We, as IOM, are present on the ground, are involved in monitoring the situation with our colleagues for the UN High Commissioner for Refugee Office, and we provide assistance to the government of the region to cope with this issue. So we can have a sort of a first-hand knowledge of the composition of these groups, and we are actually undertaking a survey to establish their social compositions. We will be able to have some preliminary results, I think, early next week. At the moment, the largest group is in Mexico, as you know. There is a caravan of about some 4,000 people in the state of Oaxaca, and there is another group about the same size that is in the city of Tapachula. I think the engagement of the Mexican government in the city of Tapachula is remarkable because they are setting up very, you know, from scratch, a way station, if you like, a migration station to provide a referral for refugee status determination. And we are supporting this effort, and we are providing direct basic humanitarian assistance in the form of shelter, water, health response and sanitation to make sure that this operation doesn't become, you know, out of hand. But the response of the Mexican authorities is encouraging, and we are working with them to make sure that their system to process refugee applications is well tested and responsive, so that we'll have also a direct impact on the future route of the caravans. I think that's an important element. The other important element, which is particularly concerning IOM as an organization, is what we provide aside from this humanitarian assistance. And basically, we provide voluntary return assistance to the countries of origin. At the moment, we already have some 5,000 people that return to Honduras from a number of areas, including the current caravans. But there is quite a number of people that are opting for return, and we encourage return, particularly when it comes out of informative decisions about their chances and the regular migration channels. Our effort is to promote regular migration. This is, if you like, the mandate of IOM, and we are receiving support from a number of governments to facilitate voluntary return operations, particularly aiming at the most vulnerable groups among them. There are, you know, as you can imagine, the composition of these caravans include young children and unaccompanied minors and women without head of households, and you know the risks. That's why the people are traveling together, probably to escape some of the related risks that usually characterize these irregular movements towards the U.S. borders. You know, handing in the hands of traffickers, smugglers, people that eventually extort them. You know, there are some appalling statistics. Almost the majority of women traveling to the U.S. in route are subjected to sexual and gender-based violence. Probably is not the only reason, but one of the reasons that explain why people are traveling in mass is also a sort of self-protection from all these risks.
Hans, to you, when he received news that there's this massive caravan taking off from Honduras and they have their intentions set on coming to the United States, can you tell us a bit about President Trump's response?
Well, he should be concerned. I mean, first of all, everyone needs to understand that we are a very generous country when it comes to legal immigration. You know, we take in more legal immigrants than any other country in the world, more than a million a year. But we have to enforce our law against illegal immigration. And the thousands of aliens who are in these caravans are clearly intent on not taking advantage of our legal immigration system, but coming here illegally. And I don't think the president really has any choice other than to try to stop what would be a mass intrusion across the border. Let me point out that most of the news reporting, interviews with people in the caravan, make it very clear they're coming here for economic reasons and other things like that. They don't have legitimate asylum claims. You know, American law is very specific on this. Again, we're very generous with asylum claims too. But our statute says that you have to be persecuted or have fear of persecution for very specific reasons, your political opinions, your race, your religion, etc. These individuals, if they are not claiming asylum in Mexico, when they get to the U.S., we should not consider their asylum claims here credible. And the reason for that is very simple. Someone who claims that they're being persecuted, for example, in Honduras by the Honduran government because of their political opinions cannot credibly claim when they get to Mexico that the Mexican government is going to be persecuting them for those same political opinions. So if they don't assert asylum in Mexico, then it's very clear that they're not coming to the U.S. to assert asylum, but they want to use that as a way of getting into the country. And just this past summer in June, Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued a decision in a specific immigration case in which he directed the adjudicators of asylum claims to take into account as a factor in determining whether that asylum claim was credible or not, whether or not the alien went through a third country where they had the ability to assert asylum. And two things about that. One, Mexico has a very generous asylum law adopted in 2011. It's actually broader than American law. And second, we would simply be following what other countries do. The European Union, for example, has a pact called the Dublin Regulation. And it says that individuals who want to assert asylum in the EU have to do so in the first country they get to.
I need to take a break right now. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/encounter, or from iTunes. Here's a shout-out to a Facebook fan, Andongo Lango from Lira, Uganda. If you would like your name mentioned on Encounter, get in touch with us either through Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or by sending us an old-fashioned email to encounter@voanews.com. And now back to our program. Today we are talking about the challenges of mass migration. My guests are Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation and Luca D'Aglio from the International Organization for Migration. Hans, I understand that as the caravans were building up a few weeks ago, that the Mexican government did offer asylum in their country, but a number of them have turned down that.
Yeah, and that tells you that their asylum claims are not credible. Under Mexican law, once you assert an asylum claim, there's a commission in Mexico that investigates and determines whether it's a credible claim or not. Until that commission comes up with its final decision, You can't be deported. You can't be removed from Mexico. So if they had credible asylum claims, they could assert them in Mexico.
Luca, your thoughts on that?
There are many drivers for mass migration, and we know that we define these movements as mixed flows. And when we say mixed flows, we mean that there are various considerations. Certainly, family reunification plays a role, or the aspiration towards family reunification plays a role, and that obviously is not something that would qualify for asylum. Economic deprivation also plays a role, and again, this is not something that would qualify for a well-founded fear of persecution and does not need international protection. But there are other issues also in certain of these countries where gang violence and a collapse of law and order, extortion, and other phenomenon of direct violence on women people are really relevant and tend to explain the consistency of these movements. There is also a pattern in the region. These countries are rapidly changing their, if you like, migration profile. Mexico used to be a country of immigration. Now the number of Mexicans returning to Mexico exceeds the number of Mexicans leaving the country. It's a country that is looking at these flows and way of regularizing them, some of them through the measures that have just been mentioned, you know, assessing whether or not they have a well-founded fear of persecution, but also establish perhaps some regular migration channels based on economic needs and skills that we are working together with the Mexican authorities to provide alternative. Because going to this country and say you cannot, with information campaigns to deter people from leaving the country is not really useful or particularly effective. But to provide alternative, it is. And the initiative of the Mexican authority to establish some regular migration channels is something that for IUM is very important. Our aim, again, as I said, is to move away from irregular migration by finding alternative path for regular migration for people that have the qualifications and the entitlement to play a useful role both for the societies of immigration for themselves. So we are looking into this matter. There is also other issues in Central America. I mean, the countries of the region have been taking steps to develop their capacities to manage migration. I mean, Panama has become a country of immigration. Costa Rica is absorbing an increasing number of Nicaraguans. Mexico is playing a useful role in this crisis. And we are also facing instability in Nicaragua. We are also facing a situation in Venezuela where 2 million Venezuelans have left in the last 2 years their country and are crossing the border between Venezuela and Colombia at a pace of 5,000 persons a day, actually walking through. If the countries in the regions are not supported in absorbing this number of Venezuelans, well, they might turn away from Argentina, Chile, Peru, Colombia, and perhaps redirect their hopes towards the north. Mm-hmm. So I think it's in the interest of everybody to look at these issues in a more, if you like, strategic way, looking at the regional characteristics and how to support the countries to create mechanisms to absorb immigrants, to provide to the states the capacities to do so, to look into the communities and the effect that this is having at the community level, because we also have a phenomenon of rejection in Brazil. And we know that humanitarian fatigue is running thin in a number of countries that are experiencing inflows from Venezuela and from Central America. So the hope is for us as an intergovernmental organization to create regional mechanisms to deal with this crisis, not just to address the crisis of the day, but also look at the medium and long term.
Hans, as Luca just mentioned, he talked about a number of Mexican officials trying to process asylum requests and that they only can work so fast. I understand the U.S. is in a similar situation where they're backed up as well. And with this influx of people seeking asylum, they're going to be kind of overwhelmed.
That's true. But the point is that once you file an asylum claim in Mexico, then you can't be removed. So the fact that it may take the Mexican government a while to work its way through that means that those individuals, those aliens in the caravan, can stay in Mexico. What I'm talking about here is that I don't believe that the American government should allow these individuals to even get into the country. The standard thing that happens at ports of entry, if you have an asylum claim, is that you are not allowed into the United States while your asylum claim is being reviewed. And I think it should be prima facie evidence that you don't have a credible asylum claim to the individual, the officials that evaluate that, if you cannot show that you try to assert asylum in Mexico, because there's no reason for you not to do that. And that, like I said, throws into question the credibility of your assertion that you're entitled to asylum. And Look, Rick, let me add. It's clear that there are economic and other problems in the parts of Central and South America that we've been talking about. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do, the United States tries to do with its foreign aid and other programs, is to try to improve the conditions in those countries. Everything from trying to help those countries stem the violence to trying to improve their economies. But we don't have the ability as a nation to simply open our borders to everyone in the world who is in a country that has not the best economic conditions, doesn't have the best civil conditions. We can't do that. We could not handle, like I said, we already take in 1 million legal immigrants a year. We could not handle the tens of millions of people who would come to the United States if we threw our borders open and said, anyone who's having a problem anywhere in what we have always referred to as a third world, anyone who's having a problem in those countries, you're welcome to come. We cannot handle that as a society, economically or otherwise.
I will not comment on what are the absorption capacity of a big economy and how many people can be allowed to enter in a manner that is legal. But the perception of the public that we are no longer controlling the border, I think, is the worst aspect that will make migrants' life difficult. And this in Europe is, as much as it is in the U.S., a very relevant issue. In Italy, for instance, the perception, if you ask somebody, I am Italian, so perhaps I can make some comments on my own country without entering the country, other countries. But if you ask, carry out a poll and we'll ask how many percentage of immigrants in Italy, people would say 20-30%. Tripling actually the actual size. If you would ask what is their religion, probably would say the largest majority are from Muslim. Well, again, is a misperception. There is a need to have evidence-based debates on these issues. Otherwise, we'll just make impossible for policymakers to handle with these topics in a way that is planned and has a long-term views in mind, keeping into account that there are drivers for migrations that are, way beyond the control of the current administrations around the world. I mean, we have take the case of Africa. You were mentioning beginning, issues facing the doubling aspect. Well, the population of Africa by 2050 will reach 2.5 billion people. The size of the African countries will double in the next 25 years. There will be a need for creating 800 million jobs, and the population, the African population, 60% of the African population is below 25 years of age. So this enormous number of young people looking for employment opportunities which are not available in the country, where they will turn to. They will take the routes across the Sahara. They will take, these smuggling networks, which many of them turn them into slave-like conditions in Libya. And of course, European countries are at the moment unable to have a policy to address these issues, which only shifts the routes from one country to another. We had people coming through Greece, going to the Balkan countries. Then we had a major route across the Central Mediterranean directed to Italy. Now we see, again, the shifting towards Spain. It is an issue that requires more comprehensive solutions, not just moving the problem from one country to the next.
Rick, let me just say something about that, because I will agree about the public perception issue. And I'll agree on that by quoting to you something that I think is very important. Rick, you remember Barbara Jordan? Barbara Jordan was a congresswoman from the state of Texas. She was an icon of the civil rights movement in the United States. She was the first African-American woman elected to the Texas Senate, and then one of the first African-American women elected to the U.S. Congress. In the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was president, he put her in charge of a commission on immigration reform. And she said something that I think is very important for us to remember, and I'm just paraphrasing her here, but she said that controlling illegal immigration and enforcing our laws against immigration was very, very important, because if we don't do that, it would undermine the public support for legal immigration. And the public support for legal immigration to the country has always been, particularly in the last 50 years, has been very good, and we want to stay that way. But that will get undermined if people perceive that we are not enforcing our laws against illegal immigration, and we are extending to illegal immigrants who are in this country the same rights as citizens.
Hans, about a week ago, President Trump announced that the U.S. will cut off or substantially reduce foreign aid given to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. What kind of impact do you think this will have on the crisis and life of those in the Central American countries and Mexico?
The one thing I would say about that is that, you know, we believe in providing foreign aid to countries, particularly foreign aid that is geared towards improving democracy, improving the economic conditions in those countries, and reducing violence as it occurs in those countries. And I think, I don't know if the president is going to do this or what the plans are for it, but I think what ought to be done is you take a close look at the foreign aid you're giving to those countries, and you take a look at how are the countries using that aid. You know, are they using it actually in the ways that we want them to and that we think will actually improve conditions? If they're not, if they're abusing that money, if they're not using it in the methods, then, yeah, you threaten or you perhaps cut off aid. But I think you have to take a very close look.
I think every country has the right to make conditionality for foreign aid. And in fact, that's the practice in many, many donor countries. But on the other hand, we cannot expect the foreign aid is a magic formula to stem migration. These are long processes, and even countries that have benefited from substantial foreign aid do not see their out-migration decline suddenly. This will take, two generations to happen, or perhaps more. This doesn't mean that, therefore, there is no incentive to provide foreign aid. These are long-term processes. You have to have also other conditions, education, good governance, investment, not only for foreign aid, but also private investments. But on the other hand, what we advocate as IOM is that sensible return migration policies should also look at the communities of out-migration and invest in these communities so that these returns do not come, ephemeral, and people are convinced to try to re-engage themselves, have the tools to do so, have the educational opportunities, have some skills and perhaps some upgrading on their skills and capitals to reinvest in the countries that they have left. And this is very important. It's not just an issue that pertains to Central America, but most of the strategy that the European Union is developing with the countries of West Africa is only also based on, yes, on the return, but also to creating at home basic conditions to make those returns sustainable in the longer term.
Looking at this current crisis with the caravans approaching north, and it appears to some that the president and his colleagues may be taking advantage politically of this situation since we've got midterm elections. Do you see the politicization of this ongoing crisis?
No. I mean, it wasn't the president that organized these caravans to start approaching the U.S. Right before the election. And I think regardless of whether an election is coming up, the president is doing what he needs to be doing, which is thinking about how are we going to handle this? What are we going to do when and if, for example, 7,000 individuals show up at the southern border and attempt to illegally cross it? And that's a tough situation to handle.
So what is going to happen?
As you know, the president has announced that he's sending upwards of at least 5,000 military troops to the border to help support the border patrol. And I think what he's going to have to do, in essence, try to shut down the border to avoid allowing these individuals to come across and engage in a mass incursion across the border. As you know, some people have raised the issue that that's an improper use of the military. Folks may not realize this, but we actually have a law often referred to in the United States as the Posse Comitatus Act. And it bans American military forces from being used for domestic law enforcement. So, yes, U.S. troops can't be used 100 miles inside our border to arrest illegal aliens who are here. But that law does not prevent the president from sending troops to the border to prevent aliens from crossing over the border. And it doesn't prevent him from having those troops give administrative support to the Border Patrol, which is authorized to arrest and detain illegal aliens.
And with that, I'm afraid we are out of time for this edition for Encounter. My guests were Hans von Spakovsky, manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and senior legal fellow with the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and Luca D'Olio, chief of mission for the Washington Office of the International Organization for Migration and board member of USA for IOM. Thanks to both of you for joining me today, and thanks for your insights.
Sure, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to our studio technician, Wagner Roberts. Encounter was produced at the VOA Studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another encounter on the Voice of America.